From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Richmond in East Bay.
Terry Hills Benoll.
Dolores at Market Street.
Daly City.
Outer Sunset.
Castro and Church.
Edge of the Mission.
The Yorktown. Antioch.
Coming up, a special series on the history of Oakland's Chinatown.
We were essentially raised in the back of the restaurant on Webster Street. We were all stacked back there, too. And we would just while away time there reading comic books.
We'll hear about how this unique neighborhood developed.
And so when he immigrated in 1928, he pretended to be somebody else's son. So he was what we call a paper name, a paper son.
And how urban planners changed the landscape.
I mean, the most absurd plan was to tear down the entire downtown. I mean, you can't imagine the foolishness of this.
It's a special series produced with Mills College in Oakland, today on Cross Currents. Welcome to a special edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan.
It was the most beautiful home on the block. And it was like you're entering into a wealthy home in China.
We'd go around and we would actually, like the Pied Piper, collect our Sunday school students.
We were essentially raised in the back of the restaurant on Webster Street, the New Eastern Cafe, and the kids. We were all stacked back there too. And we would just while away time there reading comic books.
Today we're going to talk about old news.
Oh, you mean you're talking about history here?
Yep, lots of local history. We're going to go back in time today to hear about one neighborhood in Oakland.
The place I grew up, Oakland's Chinatown.
That's right. That's journalist William Wong, and he's here to help take us on this audio journey through Oakland's Chinatown. So, Bill, what was the neighborhood like when you were growing up?
It was a very cozy, friendly, kind of in a bubble because it was a very small, but a Chinatown that had a lot of families, as in my memory, although in total there weren't that many. But it had families, children my age. The streets were very safe to play in. And our parents ran the businesses along Webster and 8th and Franklin, a little bit on Harrison, a little bit on 9th, some on 7th.
And you grew up in a restaurant, right?
I grew up in a restaurant right in the middle of the 700 block of Webster Street. And I was born on the 700 block of Harrison Street, one block away.
Sort of the heart of Chinatown. So we'll be hearing a lot of stories that weave a tapestry of life in Oakland's Chinatown neighborhood over the past 70 years or so. Our series only goes back to about the 1930s, but we have a couple of historians to help guide us as well. And one thing that they've said, Bill, that we need to understand in order to be grounded in how Chinatown evolved is the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act. So let's hear from historian Anna Neruda.
The Chinese Exclusion Law of 1882 was actually the nation's first immigration law. Before that, there was no border to the U.S. Entering the country, the biggest thing you'd do is you'd go through customs and you'd pay duty on goods. And the intent of the Chinese Exclusion Law was to keep as many people of Chinese descent out of the U.S. as possible.
That's historian Anna Neruda. She says that these restrictive immigration laws, along with the extreme racism, are what created the Chinatown neighborhoods that we still have today. And Bill, I know that this part of our history is really painful, but it's also really important to remember how explicit the racial hatred was. Now, you're holding a couple of newspapers from the early 20th century. The first one is the Oakland Herald from 1906, obviously right after the earthquake. Can you read from that for us?
Sure. April 27th, 1906, from the Oakland Herald. One of the evils springing from the late disaster to San Francisco, one that menaces Oakland exceedingly, but that seems to have escaped attention, is the great influx of Chinese into this city from San Francisco. Not only have they pushed outward the limits of Oakland's heretofore constricted and insignificant Chinatown, but they have settled themselves in large colonies throughout the residence parts of the city, bringing with them their vices and their filth.
And you have another from 1923. Can you read from that?
Right. 16th of February, 1923, a clipping from an English language newspaper. We don't know which one it is. Just two paragraphs regarding Chinese meat markets. After buying meat in one of the gilded markets of the Chinese, have you ever taken a stroll down a block or so to Chinatown proper? An unclean, tumble-down section out of which came the men who sold you the meat? Did it ever occur to you that the whole of what we call Chinatown should be condemned by the health department because of the many tuberculosis-breeding shacks?
So that gives us a little bit of context for the stories we're about to hear. It seems that that extreme racism of the early 20th century began to lessen as we enter World War II, right? When China is an ally of the U.S. and some of this begins to melt away.
Correct. World War II was a very important marker for the change in the sort of white society's attitudes towards Chinatown. It didn't change overnight, but it was beginning.
It was beginning.
Right.
So now let's go to an area called Madison Park. And this next story starts during the post-war period. Here's reporter Annabelle Peterson.
It was the most beautiful home on the block. And it was like you're entering into a wealthy home in China.
Nona Mok Wyman came to the Mingkwong Home for Girls in 1946. She was 12 years old and had already been living in orphanages for most of her life. She remembers entering her new home.
When you go up the front steps, there's the two lions to guard you, and it's a very impressive house.
It was a big blue Victorian building with a well-kept garden on the edge of Oakland's Chinatown. Wyman says it stood out from the rundown houses nearby. The home was called Mingkwong, Chinese for radiant light, and it was run by the Presbyterian Church. It housed girls whose parents had died or couldn't take care of them. Nona Mok Wyman says coming to the home was like walking into a mansion.
And the living room is very big, and it has nice antique Chinese furniture that was probably donated to the home. And Chinese rugs.
On one side, an elegant staircase with a gleaming wooden handrail led to the second floor where the girls slept. It was often referred to as an orphanage, but not all the girls were orphans. Wyman says no one explained to her why she was given up as a small child, but she believes it was because her mother was sick with tuberculosis.
I came to the home when I was 2.5 years old, crying and screaming my little head off.
Wyman's friend, Bernice Lee Gu, knows exactly why she ended up at the home for girls. Her mother had already passed away.
In my case, my father worked at night, and so as a result, my brother and I ran wild doing all kinds of things until juvenile hall came in, and then they contacted the Presbyterian Board of National Missions.
In some cases, a culture clash was at play. Some Protestant reformers believed working-class parents, especially single parents, couldn't raise their children properly. In any case, for Nona Mok Wyman and Bernice Lee Gu, Mingkwong was home. Most of their childhood was spent in the beautiful Victorian with about 25 other girls, some of whom came to be like sisters.
We couldn't wait for a new girl to come because we could, what's your name, da-da-da, and everything, where are you from?
What do you have? Let's look at your clothes.
But mostly, Lee Gu says the girls lived a life of routine and discipline.
When we got up, we did our whatever chores we were assigned. Then we had breakfast, then we had to go upstairs, make our beds, and clean our rooms. And there was a sheet on the door when the staff member came in and inspected your room. If something wasn't right, she would write it on the door.
Still, there was time for play. Any house full of teenaged girls is bound to have its share of inside jokes and pranks.
We used to have this really funny joke we used to do. You probably don't know the song. It goes, you sigh, the song begins, and I hear music, and it's magic, and then we take the back of someone's bra and snap it, and everybody would laugh.
It's magic. It was at Mingkwong that the girls grew into women. Mok Wyman admits that her nickname was Greenhorn because she didn't know anything about the opposite sex. Both women remember the boy they had a crush on. Mok Wyman, now 76, holds up a drawing of a boy with high cheekbones, his hair slicked back like a character from Grease.
Bernice, who is this person?
That is Bobby Joe.
And who is Bobby Joe?
Well, he was first Lila Young's boyfriend. And then after she left, was yours?
No.
I was last.
Just once. You were actually his girlfriend?
Mm-hmm.
See, I didn't even know that.
Even 60 years later, the two women are giggling like schoolgirls as they look at the picture.
I just know that you were infatuated with him, so I just brought this here today just so you...
To perk me up. Doesn't he look like a movie star?
Although the girls' lives were a lot like those of other young women, sometimes it was clear they were different.
At the home, if your mother was alive, you wore a red rose.
Was it on Mother's Day?
Mother's Day.
Right.
And if your mother was deceased, you wore a pink rose. So because my mother never came to visit me, after all these years, I would say, is my mother still alive? I'd tell the teacher, ask the teacher that.
One year, the teachers gave Nona Mock Wyman a pink rose because they decided that her mother had probably died from tuberculosis.
So how about you, Bernice?
No, I always had the pink rose because they knew my mother was gone.
We were just all happy everybody had a rose.
Yeah.
The girls didn't know any other way of life. And Mock Wyman remembers how difficult it was to leave her Ming Kuang family after she graduated from high school.
It was like the worst part of my life.
Girls weren't allowed to stay once they became adults.
Leaving the home that you grew up in, leaving all the girls, I cried all the way from Oakland to Palo Alto.
Today, Mock Wyman owns a boutique in Walnut Creek named after the home she grew up in, and Lee Gu is retired. Every few years, a group of Ming Kuang girls meets to talk about their time together. But while they've stayed in contact, their former home was eventually torn down to make way for the Lake Merritt BART station. The women visited the site on one of their reunions.
When we walked around and I said, well, this is where I lived, and here it was a BART station.
It was so beautiful, too.
I know.
The casual passerby would have no way of knowing what used to be where the station is now. The history of the Ming Kuang home is kept alive only through the memories of the women who grew up there. To help preserve those stories, Nona Mock Wyman wrote a memoir about her time in the orphanage called Chopstick Childhood. The three-block area that included Ming Kuang Home for Girls is now up for redevelopment again. The BART Plaza that replaced the home may itself be transformed with new buildings and public spaces, continuing a cycle of change that sometimes leaves the past behind in the quest for a better future. In Oakland, I'm Annabelle Peterson for Cross Currents.
You're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents from KALW News, produced with Mills College in Oakland. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm here with journalist and author William Wong. So, Bill, we just heard about the Ming Kuang Home for Girls. What do you remember about it?
Well, I didn't have any direct dealings with the Ming Kuang Home myself because the Ming Kuang Home was approximately five blocks from Commercial Chinatown, Webster or Harrison, that's where I hung out. But I certainly knew young women or girls who lived at the Ming Kuang home. And I remember very distinctly that one of my sisters, who was about 6 or 7 years older than me, had a very good friend named Amy, who was a Ming Kuang home girl. So we saw Amy and Leslie, my sister, socializing together. And through that, we learned that she was a Ming Kuang girl. And through the general reputation, I remember that was a home for girls without mothers. And it was a place that it was a beautiful building. I remember walking by it and seeing it at some point. But we never hung there very much. But I think it sort of symbolizes the story of the gender imbalance in immigration for Chinese women. Were not generally allowed to come under the restrictions of the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act because it was really an act that wanted to hold down Chinese laborers, but it was possible through a quirk in the 1906 earthquake, which destroyed records, that some Chinese were able to be claimed being sons of natives.
The so-called paper sons.
The paper son phenomenon. And because of the economic growth in the West, and Oakland included in California, many employers wanted Chinese laborers, even though the Chinese Exclusion Act existed. But with this little quirk called the paper son phenomenon, some Chinese men were able to come into the United States claiming to be sons of natives, but there was a kind of a rule against bringing women in, and spouses especially.
And so there was a great imbalance. And so that's why there's a lot of girls, very few women, and a lot of men.
Correct.
So let's hear from Greg Mark, who's a professor at Sacramento State University, and he talks about this taboo subject of paper sons.
And it's kind of complicated, but Mark isn't my real last name. It's Yi. But I was given Albert after my grandfather, Albert Wong. And Mark was a name that my father bought in China, and it was pronounced Mok. And so when he immigrated in 1928, you know, he had coaching papers and so on. He pretended to be somebody else's son. So he was what we call a paper name, a paper son. And I'm the son of a paper son. And so so my dad, as with many, many other Chinese American men, came over the 20s and the 30s under false names, paper names. And this is why, again, we have this kind of, it's a taboo topic in my community, because when growing up, they were all afraid of being discovered by INS and being deported.
That's Professor Greg Mark talking about so-called paper sons. Immigration was so restricted from China that there was this small loophole after the 1906 earthquake when paperwork was lost, and so people were able to use other people's names to get into the United States.
That's exactly right. And my father also may have been a paper son. The records are a little unclear that I got from the National Archives office in San Bruno. And we do know that in the case of my father, he did claim to have sired three sons in China. Within our family, we don't know who these sons are, so we figured that he was also playing the paper son game, because what would happen then would be his ability to sell those slots to other people who wanted to use them to come into the United States under the guise of being a son of a native. So the bottom line is there was an elaborate scheme within the Chinese community to get around the restrictions of the 1882 Exclusion Act, because there was such a compelling drive on their part to come here to get work, at first to find gold in the 1800s and later just to find work because they came from very poor villages.
That's William Wong, and he's here to help us tell the story of Oakland's Chinatowns. Let's go to our next story, Bill. This next story is about the same three-square block area called Madison Park, but we're going to go to the opposite end of where the Ming Kuang Home for Girls was. We're going to go to the corner where Madison Park is today, but at one point that was a neighborhood, a residential neighborhood, and we've got reporter Lindsay Lee to take us back in time.
It's paved over now. But the house where Fran Toy grew up was right here, where Madison Park is today.
I lived there from the moment I came home from the hospital until 4 days before my 22nd birthday, when I left to get married.
Toy says it was a safe neighborhood, full of Victorian duplexes and apartment buildings.
And we didn't even lock our front doors, our back doors.
Like Toy's own family, most of her neighbors were working class, many of them immigrants from China. Toy says she grew up during the Depression, but she and her siblings didn't know they were poor.
And we played in the streets a lot because, after all, I mean, I was born in the 30s. There weren't that many cars going up and down the streets. And so we just, you know, we played. I think the guys played, you know, kick the can or something. And we saved the paper caps from the milk bottles that were delivered, and we played with that. It was just a very peaceful childhood.
Peaceful, but busy.
The majority of us as children went to what we called American school in the morning and then to the early afternoon. And then we had a little breather, and then we went to Chinese school before dinner.
There was always something to do. And for Toy's family, that included spending a lot of time at the True Sunshine Episcopal Church.
My mother was a very faithful Christian, very devout. And she gave hours to the church. She volunteered herself. Of course, she volunteered her children. So every Saturday, she marched my brother, my sister, and me from 8th Street, where we lived, around the corner to the church. And we cleaned the church for Sunday services.
At that time, Toy was planning to be a nurse when she grew up. And her brother and sister used that fact to their advantage.
I got conned by my older siblings to clean the lavatories because that would be good practice for emptying bedpans. And I think I can still remember how awful it was in the boys' bathroom, the men's bathroom.
Cleaning toilets wasn't her only duty at the church.
We used to go, my sister and I and about three other young ladies, we'd go around and we would actually, like the Pied Piper, collect our Sunday school students. We'd walk them to church Sunday morning and then afterwards we'd walk them back home.
The congregation was mainly Cantonese speaking, and so was the neighborhood.
As far as I can remember, all our neighbors on either side or across the street were all Chinese.
But the tightly knit neighborhood of Fran Toy's childhood would eventually face big changes. It was slated for demolition as a part of the city's plan to eliminate what it called urban blight. UC Berkeley geographer Richard Walker.
In the mid 20th century, Victorian houses were regarded as old dogs and, you know, completely out of fashion and clunky. So that's the kind of mindset of the downtown business people that you would have circa 1950.
Walker says that mindset allowed for a top-down approach to redevelopment. City planners decided to level three blocks to make way for a new BART station and headquarters.
Now, there's also, of course, an unspoken or sometimes pretty straightforward racism and classism that says, you know, we want to get rid of these unsavory people, whether they're the new African-American populations that had come in during World War II or the Chinese.
Walker says bringing BART to Oakland was a victory for the city. But at that time, it was a big surprise for most of the residents who would be displaced.
Ordinary people would have had very little idea what was going on. A lot of this goes on behind closed doors. So people will find out often, ordinary people, at the last minute.
Between 1964 and 1966, BART acquired all of the properties on those three blocks, displacing 75 Chinese households.
And that's how we lost our home.
Fran Toy saw her childhood community transform under the pressure of redevelopment. The lives of her family members and neighbors changed drastically.
They were all quite devastated, and it forced them to move elsewhere in Oakland.
But that wasn't the hardest part for Fran Toy's family.
I didn't lose only my family home, but even more importantly, we lost our spiritual home because this church was right there around the corner from my home.
The loss was significant. In many ways, Toy grew up inside the church. It's where her parents met.
In my whole lifetime, I saw my mother cry twice. Once when her mother died, and the second time was when the bishop came to deconsecrate the space because it was going to be torn down and no longer a church.
The church was demolished. The members moved to a different building, but it was miles away, up in the hills on Lincoln Avenue.
And so we lost congregation members by the drove. And I remember one Sunday going to church, and the priest and I were the only two people there.
The redevelopment of the neighborhood left residents sad and angry. But Toy says they resigned themselves to the change and didn't protest.
It's not part of our culture to mobilize and resist, not back in the 1960s. When you grow up in a culture where the people at the top have ultimate control, you don't resist.
Later generations would resist and indeed transform the way redevelopment worked. In the mid-60s, Fran Toy's family lost its home and church. But two decades later, Toy's history would come full circle.
I was ordained the first Asian American female priest in the Episcopal Church.
The Reverend Dr. Fran Toy, her official title, is retired now. and the Episcopal Church has found a new home in the heart of Oakland's Chinatown. It now resides on Harrison near 10th. Toy still attends services there every so often, returning to her roots. In Oakland, I'm Lindsay Lee Keel for Cross Currents.
You're listening to a special edition of Cross Currents from KALW News, produced with students from Mills College in Oakland. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm joined by author William Wong, who grew up in Oakland's Chinatown, and he's helping us explore the history of this one neighborhood. So, Bill, we're beginning to get a picture of what life was like in the Madison Park area from about the 30s to the 60s. And the one thing that really strikes me is the idea that the neighborhood seemed dominant by just one culture, a very specific Cantonese culture.
Right. These were families just like ours. We grew up just outside of that three-block zone, but it was connected to Chinatown in general. And the families came from a specific part of the Pearl River Delta region of China, which, you know, in terms of what people understand now, the greater Hong Kong area. And the Pearl River Delta region really produced a lot of migrants from China in the 1800s that come over for gold. And then later, it would be kind of a stream of immigrants coming from that area. So we came from sort of really very similar backgrounds, dialects, and language and culture.
Again, that's William Wong. He's a journalist, author, and historian, and he grew up just a few blocks away from the Madison Square area. Many of the people that we spoke with for this series remember one thing really clearly, Bill, and that is American school, so-called American school during the day, and Chinese school evenings and weekends. Let's hear from Fran Toy.
And when we were growing up, we had a Chinese school in our dining room. And so the children came to our house on Monday afternoon after American school, and they would take our dining room apart and make it into a classroom. And then on Friday afternoon before they left, they would take apart the classroom stuff and then restore our dining room for the weekend. And it was one way to grow up.
And so, Bill, is that how you grew up, too? Is this a common experience?
Well, that was a very interesting story. I have not heard that particular anecdote before. But what I know and remember was that there were a number of so-called private small Chinese schools dotted around the greater Chinatown area in the 30s. I went to a Chinese school in the mid-40s on 9th Street, across the street from what today is the Pacific Renaissance Plaza, called Wah-Q. Wah-Q had been a Chinese school on 8th Street before that. So it doesn't surprise me at all that a friend's family home had also been a Chinese school. But eventually they all got consolidated into the Chinese Community Center, or the Milton Shung Community Center today at the corner of 9th and Harrison, a bigger building that was built in the early 1950s.
And, you know, Chinatowns are now famous everywhere around the world for their restaurants. And your family ran a restaurant. And one of the things that you've said is that the clientele was mostly single men.
That's correct. Single men plus a few families. We saw a few families. But the other noteworthy thing is it was a multicultural clientele. It wasn't just Chinese, although Chinese were there in great numbers. But during World War II, for example, when our family's restaurant started in 1943, I was so young, I don't remember, but my sisters tell me that the customer base was many shipyard workers would come from the shipyards, which were about 6 or 8 blocks from commercial Chinatown, and they would come, and it would be people of all backgrounds, whoever was working at the shipyard. After that, it was both single men, because that's where they, you know, passed their day and ate their food, as well as some families and some other individuals who were not Chinese. So the customer base was always with a Chinese base, but also had a multicultural cast to it.
And did you like working in the restaurant?
I'm not sure liking is the correct word for me. Well, we didn't know any different. We were, you know, a very typical young Chinese-American family in those days. The parents told you what to do and you did it. So we did it. And, you know, my older sisters and I all worked there. But looking back, we gained some great value from it, you know, responsibility and working hard and all of those cliches about certain Chinese American families. It worked.
Well, let's hear from Ben Fong Torres now. He grew up in the same neighborhood as you did. Fong Torres would later go on to be an editor at Rolling Stone magazine, and he was portrayed in the movie Almost Famous. Here's Ben Fong Torres talking to Anne Huang as part of StoryCorps.
It was a mix of fun and work, basically. I think growing up in a restaurant family, I guess most of the fun was chow fun. But at first, you're just a kid. And the reason that my memoirs was titled The Rice Room is because we were essentially raised in the back of the restaurant on Webster Street, the New Eastern Cafe. And so there was this back room where there were sacks of long grain rice and supplies of soy sauce and other condiments. And the kids, we were all stacked back there too. And we would just while away time there reading comic books or then later on going to school doing some homework. And I remember my older sister teaching me how to do the cha-cha-cha. And we listened to the radio. And as soon as we were able to do chores, we carried soda pop from one room to another. We peeled prawns. We wrapped wontons. We did all the stuff that kids would do as part of a restaurant family, a working family in Chinatown.
Yeah, and I know that working at your family's restaurant consumed almost all of your time outside of school. What was it like to work so closely with your family at the restaurant?
I grew to hate them. But no, you what you do is you get a sense, and this is years later, you learn that you were infused with a sense of responsibility and a pretty positive work ethic. At that time, it wasn't so much fun or positive because we began to feel like we were losing out, missing out on social activities and school activities, that we didn't have the same shot that others did of having a circle of friends and parties and going out and doing things and just school activities, staying after school to be in a choir or a sports team. None of that was really available to us. And so I think it was a mix of the adventure of growing up and being a part of a family with the sense that you were in some way being cheated. And on top of the work, there was Chinese school that we had to go to at 3 o'clock. So for us, I think for most of us, it was number one, a bother. And then number two, if you had friends from American school, then it was a way to socialize, basically, to see them after school. And it was a little bit of an escape from the direct route home from American school back into the restaurant. Mm. So some of my favorite spots around that area were Hamburger Gus's. Because then you could have a bag of great French fries or the T&D Theater, where you can go and buy a chili dog. So these were American things. And you get tired of cha siu and all the food that your parents cooked for you. And so that was the one little thing that I got pleasure from in terms of the Chinese school thing.
When you were growing up in Chinatown, did Chinatown feel like a close-knit community to you?
Yes, I think Chinatown was, in a way, you know, when you're a kid and you're born into it, it doesn't stand out so much. And it takes the perspective of being outside of it, having the freedom to look back into it, to see that, in fact, it was, in a way, a ghetto. But in that community, there certainly was a closeness, partly because you are sort of kept to that area. You get to know the area very well, and so you develop favorite places to go hang out in when you get to hangout age. In my case, at age two, I was across the street shoplifting and... trying to sneak whiskey into the Coca-Cola bottles.
And your little diapers.
In the coffee machine. No. There was a comfort level of walking around Webster and 7th and 8th Streets and Franklin and Alice and Jackson. We just kind of got to know it pretty well.
That's Ben Fong Torres talking with Anne Huang in the StoryCorps booth at the Oakland Asian Cultural Center. Fong Torres grew up in Oakland's Chinatown, and you're listening to a special edition of KALW News produced with students from Mills College. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm here with Bill Wong, who also grew up in the same neighborhood as Fong Torres in Oakland's Chinatown. Bill, what went through your head as you were listening to Fong Torres, who had an experience similar to yours growing up in
very
a restaurant?
Very much so. And listening to Ben talk about his his memories, they echo much of my own experience. Ben's family restaurant was directly across the street from our family restaurant.
Competitors.
Well, sort of competitors. It didn't quite. There was some period of overlap. Ben is a few years younger than me. I remember his sister, Sarah, much better. She was in my class. But nonetheless, our families had similar experiences, and I agree very much with Ben's memories about having those side trips to Hamburger Gus or Hamburger Joe or the T&D Theater, which some of us call the Tough and Dirty, on 11th Street, because it was a way away from our normal routine Chinatown restaurant experience. And Fong Get Mu was a wonderful memory for many of us boys.
That's the barber.
The barber who at 8th and Harrison Street, legendary in Oakland Chinatown history of that period.
So your family started your restaurant during World War II, and that's actually the time that we want to go back to now for our next story. In 1942, President Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, and that mandated the forced internment of people of Japanese ancestry, including Americans.
Evacuation. More than 100,000 men, women, and children, all of Japanese ancestry, removed from their homes in the Pacific Coast states to wartime communities established in out-of-the-way places.
And reporter Morgan Ross has more of that story.
Two-thirds of the internees were American citizens. In 1943, the War Relocation Authority produced a film about the internment, but it didn't call it that.
They are not prisoners. They are not internees. They are merely dislocated people, the unwounded casualties of war.
They may not have been physically wounded, but the relocation was emotionally traumatizing for Japanese Americans.
You had so many business people and community members who had to leave, virtually immediately.
That's historian Anna Neruda.
They could only bring a suitcase of goods. So people had stores they had to sell under duress, to great losses.
Neruda says the hurried departure was just the beginning. For about 8,000 evacuees in the Bay Area, their first stop was the Tanfren Assembly Center in San Bruno, formerly the Tanfren Racetrack.
The horse stables were used as the residence, and they smelled. People talk about it. You knew you were forced to live in some horse stables.
From there, the Japanese Americans were sent to so-called relocation centers.
It's hard to imagine the pain of that, being told you're not loyal, you're somehow not actually American, even though you're born here like everyone else.
At the internment camps, the evacuees encountered a stark existence. They were assigned to barrack-type buildings, more than 300 people to a block. The whole camp was surrounded by a wire fence and guarded by military police.
Each family, upon arrival at a relocation center, was assigned to a single-room compartment, about 20 by 25 feet, barren, unattractive. A stove, a light bulb, cots, mattresses, and blankets. Those were the things provided by the government.
The families had left most of their possessions behind, and in many cases, they never saw them again.
I mean, literally, people would then strip their homes of their chinaware, of their furniture, and sell it, for a dime on the dollar.
Greg E. Mark is a professor of Asian studies at Sacramento State University. He says the homes themselves were often taken over by squatters.
But also, I know wonderful examples of, like here in Sacramento, of a European-American farmer who supported his friends who were interned and watched their farms. And when they came back, he gave it back to them.
Before the war, Oakland's Japanese Americans were concentrated in Chinatown, and many of them were members of the Buddhist Church of Oakland on Jackson Street. It's a burgundy Shinto shrine with black arching roofs. The current minister is Reverend Harry Gyoko Bridge. He says when the church members were forced to evacuate, many of them left their belongings here. Friendly neighbors looked after the building.
You know, and they kept an eye on this place and were able to prevent it from being vandalized.
When the war ended in 1945, it was a time of national celebration. The Allies triumphed over the Axis, and American soldiers came home to their loved ones.
The greatest, the wildest celebration of them all was in New York's Times Square. Never before or since has there been a crowd like this on the Great White Way. 2 million people screamed their elation at the end of the most devastating war in recorded history. For 24 hours, the celebration went on, and not for a minute did it lag. Victory had come. Old Glory waved over a happy land.
For the Japanese Americans returning home from internment camps in 1946, the celebration was more bittersweet. They came home to a bleak existence.
People didn't have their properties to return to, except in some cases where friends held property in their own names for their friends who were interned. Except for those few cases, people virtually lost everything, and the communities that they came from were gone.
Again, historian Anna Neruda.
It's profoundly painful, I think, and I think this is part of why, in a way, it's only getting to be now that that a lot of people are a little more ready to talk about the effects of the internment and these whole communities being rounded up and sent to the camps.
The spiritual leaders of the Buddhist Church had also been interned. Reverend Bridge says they took on the task of helping community members rebuild their lives.
After having everything taken away from you, your rights, your property, your belongings, you know, and then to have a place to come back to be able to kind of get your bearings and figure out what you're going to do, you know, after the war is over, I can only imagine that, you know, that really solidified the relationship with the church.
To help revitalize the community, the church added an auditorium, a game room, and even a nursery. But those changes were barely completed when the church underwent its second great upheaval. A new freeway was being built, and the church was in the way.
Like, kind of like in the cartoons, isn't there a Bugs Bunny cartoon where the government comes in and says, we're putting the highway through where Bugs Bunny's hole is, right? So he has to go somewhere, he fights back, right? But the reality is, you know, I don't think you can really fight something like that. So, you know, the church had to make a decision what they were going to do.
Their options were limited.
People were still having to find their own housing. There's no way they could build a new church. So they decided to move it, physically move the building.
In June of 1950, the church was literally split in half, placed on trucks, and moved 3 blocks away to the corner of 9th and Jackson Streets. Neruda says even though the move saved the building, it disrupted the already wounded community.
Because it is more than a building being moved and a congregation having to, you know, stop for a period of time and then return. It's everything has changed.
When the Buddhist Church officially reopened in 1951, the members held a celebration. But the impact of a decade of resettlement had affected the community. Members were dispersed throughout the Bay Area. Today, they still are, but they maintain their connection to the church. Reverend Bridge holds services on Sundays for the roughly 400 members. And he gives tours of the building to anyone who wants one. The church is in the process of being named a landmark in recognition of its remarkable history and ongoing importance to the Japanese American community. In Oakland, I'm Morgan Ross for Cross Currents.
dai se shu fu sai sho bing se fu jo shu.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. It's a special edition produced in association with Mills College in Oakland. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm here with William Wong, and we're exploring Oakland's Chinatown neighborhood. William Wong is a journalist who grew up in Chinatown. Bill, I'm wondering about the relationship between Chinese-American and immigrant communities and Japanese-Americans during the war. I mean, there was this vicious occupation of parts of China by Japan. What were relations like in Chinatown?
I grew up in 1941, 5 months before Pearl Harbor. And in my young childhood, I do remember a Japanese presence. And this was after the war, after the internment. And in studying the history since then, I've learned that there were a lot of Japanese-owned businesses in or near Chinatown that spread out even further, especially into West Oakland. I don't have a memory of animosity between children who were of Chinese descent versus children of Japanese descent. That may have occurred in the 1930s when Japan invaded China, and even though that happened there, the families on this side in Oakland and in California, they were paying some attention to what was going on overseas. I've heard stories like in Sacramento's Chinatown that the Chinese kids and the Japanese kids in the 1930s would be rivals and would fight one another. Mm. So there wasn't a feeling of one community. As far as I can tell from my memory and from talking to people, there was not that level of animosity. But after the war, there were obviously much fewer Japanese people in the Chinatown area.
In your book, Images of America, Oakland's Chinatown, you have this very poignant picture of a grocery store that's for sale. It's called Wanto Company, and on the storefront, it's got a huge lettering that says, "I am an American," and it looks like this is a business that was forced to quickly sell in order to relocate to the forced internment camps.
Right. I'm glad you brought that photograph up. It is actually a classic Dorothea Lange photo, who was out here in the West covering she was covering the Japanese-American internment story. So she has a lot of photographic record of that period, and she happened to be in Oakland. That store happened to be on the corner of 8th Street and Franklin, right in the heart of commercial Chinatown. And the story I hear is that the Japanese-American family, right after the Pearl Harbor bombing, decided to put up that sign, "I am an American," to tell people, customers or the public at large, that they basically were not responsible for the Pearl Harbor bombing, because by that time, the hatred of anything Japanese within America was very high.
Well, and another thing that we heard from a number of people who lived through that war period was if you were Asian American but not Japanese American, some people were wearing buttons like to say, "I am Chinese, I am not Japanese," so that they wouldn't get beat up, etc. Let's hear from Professor Greg Mark, who also grew up in Oakland's Chinatown, and he's a professor at Sacramento State. Here's what he remembers.
You know, mainstream America didn't know the difference between a Chinese and a Japanese. We all looked the same. And so there were a point, you can see it, where some Chinese were wearing "I am Chinese" buttons, so not to be mistaken for a Japanese American, you know, during World War II.
That's Professor Greg Mark, who grew up in Oakland's Chinatown, which is the neighborhood whose history we're exploring in this special edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. It's produced by students from Mills College in Oakland. I'm Holly Kernan, and our next story comes to us from StoryCorps. We're going to hear from Maria Rivera Yip. She grew up in Chinatown, and her parents ran a cleaner's on Franklin Street. She spoke with Evelyn Lulu Keeson in the StoryCorps booth at the Asian Cultural Center.
Tell us more about the cleaners. Your mom, you started out by saying that your mom purchased the cleaners around World War II or after the...
Well, actually, she bought it from a couple of a Japanese family
that was being interned, mm-hmm. put in a prison camp. And so she negotiated with them because she knew they were going to be leaving. So she borrowed some money from some uncles and paid for the cleaners. And then there's a funny story there where we went to negotiate, or the last, before the people left, they invited us for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went for dinner because they had a kitchen in the back of the cleaners.
Oh.
And so we went for dinner and we sat down. And I must mention, I was only 8 years old at the time, so mm-hmm. I have to excuse myself for being so naughty. But I remember shouting out, "I'm not going to eat this food. Those people are going to try and kill me."
Oh, really?
I was uh-huh. afraid, really.
Uh-huh.
And then my mother took me out, and she pinched me and said I'd have to go in and apologize and sit down and eat, mm-hmm. which I did. But I was afraid the whole time. I really was afraid, because on the news, all you could hear about is all the atrocities in the Philippines and, you know, during the war and everything. And I read in the papers, and my uncles took me to the theaters, and we saw the newsreels of all the things that were going on in the war. So naturally, I was afraid.
Mm. So going back to Chinatown, what was it like in Chinatown when you were growing up? Was it crowded, noisy? Were there people who were only Chinese, or Chinese and Filipino, or?
It was mostly Chinese, and it isn't like it is now. There mm-hmm. weren't that many people around.
Mm-hmm.
Not like, we didn't have any festivals and stuff like that then.
Uh-huh.
The dragon or whatever would come around when somebody opened a new store. But other than that, there wasn't that much activity in Chinatown. Just
uh-huh.
on the weekends, maybe people coming in to buy their Asian-type groceries. That was it.
That was Maria Rivera Yip speaking with Evelyn Lulukisen at the StoryCorps booth. And you're listening to a special edition of KALW News, produced in association with Mills College students in Oakland. We're exploring the history of Oakland's Chinatown, and we have William Wong here with us. He grew up there. He's a journalist and an author. Bill, any final thoughts on this during the war, post-war period, when Chinatown kind of goes into a bit of an economic decline?
Yes. Listening to Maria's story just is a reminder to me and to all of us that while the place was called Chinatown, especially before the war, it had a significant Japanese population and also a significant but smaller Filipino population. All three ethnic groups had businesses and some residents in the general neighborhood of Chinatown. So it wasn't just Chinese, but Chinese were the dominant folks. But after the war and after Pearl Harbor, it became much more Chinese and Filipino than it did Japanese because of the internment situation. So I went to a Filipino barber, and they were well known in Oakland's Chinatown at that time.
And in the next part of our series, we're going to look into how the neighborhood changes again in the 60s and 70s with the burst of new immigration from all parts of Asia. We'll continue our special series on Oakland's Chinatown tomorrow with stories from the next generation who would go off to college and return to transform the neighborhood.
Here we had a group of 20-year-olds, literally, you know, and that we could have such an impact on the city of Oakland and the Asian American community.
One thing that was our advantage is we didn't know how difficult it was to do this type of project. None of us had a track record at the time.
That's tomorrow at 5 when our series continues. You've been listening to a special edition of KALW News, produced with Mills College in Oakland. We've been exploring the history of Oakland's Chinatown. You can hear all of the stories in our series at kalwnews.org, and we invite you to add your memories from Oakland's Chinatown as well. You can call us at 415-264-7106 and leave us a message. That number again is 415-264-7106. This series was edited by Zoe Corneli and produced by Chris Hoff. We had help from Melanie Young, Thea Croman, Erica Mu, and Martina Castro. Special thanks to William Wong for accompanying us on this audio tour. We're also grateful to Roy Chan and Anne Huang for their production assistance, and to Serena Chen. The reporters for this series are Lupe Cáceres, Jennifer Courtney, Lindsay Lee Keel, Tashina Maniak, Annabelle Peterson, Morgan Ross, Melody Sage, Priscilla Wilson, and Sina Woodson. They're all students at Mills College in Oakland. Our managing editor is Ben Trefney. Also thanks to Sarah Geis and StoryCorps for their help with this series. You can find out more about sharing your stories through StoryCorps and the Asian Cultural Center's memory map by going to klwnews.org. Thanks for joining us on this audio tour of Oakland's Chinatown. For Mills College and KALW Public Radio, I'm Holly Kernan.